Well, let's open in prayer. Father, we thank you for this day. We thank you for providing rain for us this year, where we've had droughts in the past, and we thank you that we don't have that problem this year. Father, we thank you for bringing us together in your house this morning. Thank you for the opportunity to study about your creation, study about other people's views of your creation. Father, we pray that you would help us to understand what I have to teach. I would pray that I would teach clearly. Pray that we would all enjoy it. It's in Christ's name we pray. Amen.
Amen.
Come on in, Paul. Oh, okay, it's Carlos. That was close. Paul's coming, actually. Okay, just to review last class. Anybody remember, just in one word, what we studied last class? Okay, good, good. Well, I was just hoping at least you got that, right? Anybody remember what metaphysics is at a high level?
Beyond the physical.
Beyond, well, okay, so that's where it got its name, but what is it? What's the study?
Ethereal.
Study of reality.
Study of reality, okay, good. What is real? What does is mean? See when... Seriously, actually, yeah. Well, what's funny is that, I mean, of course, Bill Clinton made that statement, depends on what the meaning of is, but it's a valid question, right? If I say I am here, that's different from saying I am human, right? It's different. So anyway, but yeah, that's one of the questions you ask in metaphysics. Last class, we studied about what the Christian view of reality is. We talked about the ultimate reality being God. God is a source of reality. God is a source of all being. We learned that the world, we believe that it is made up of two substances, the material substances and the immaterial substances. That makes us substance dualists. You know, you can drop that in a cocktail conversation if we ever go to one. The world was created good, but the world fell with man, and it's to be redeemed. We believe that abstract entities, mathematical numbers, ideas, properties like red or here or that kind of thing, we believe they have real non-spatial, non-temporal existence. We believe that they actually exist apart from matter. We believe that man was created in the image of God and fallen, and some of man will be and have been redeemed by Christ. Okay. That's a very high-level summary of our view of reality. Today we're going to cover other views of reality and how they try to account for some of the problems they might have. Okay, so we are dualists. What does that mean again? I just said it. So it should be easy, right? Right, material and material. There are other dualists out there, but we're going to talk about monists today because they're a little bit more common. Monist, as opposed to dualist, means there's only one of anything. And it does not always necessarily mean that they only believe that there's matter. They can believe other things, like all there is energy, or all there is Brahman, or whatever. First we'll talk about physicalists, and then we'll talk about Hindu. We'll just call it Hindu for the sake of the class, but it actually covers a lot more than that. Okay, monism. Physicalists believe that all there is matter. Whatever form it takes, whatever it boils down to, all there is matter. Okay? This is a very, very common view today. The majority of scientists believe this. The majority of people more or less just sort of swallow this idea when it's handed to them by the media and by whatever. Ultimate reality is what? Ultimate reality is matter. It all boils down to matter. No God. If God exists, then he fits. He's material as well. So in other words, the God of the Bible is not ultimate reality to a physicalist. What is ultimate reality? Matter, energy. Matter can be particles, matter can be strings, matter can be all kinds of different things. But as long as it's matter, you can be called a physicalist. And that's usually not argued in the scientific community. They might argue about what the nature of matter is, but ultimate reality is ultimate reality is impersonal. Ultimate reality is matter. Okay. Now, just to raise some things we're not really going to talk about, there are still a lot of questions in the physicalist world to be answered. Namely, they don't try to answer why, usually, and they usually understand that they cannot answer why, so they usually don't try to. But there are other things that have not yet been explained. For instance, gravity, or the strong nuclear force which holds neutrons and protons together, weak nuclear force. These things haven't been, magnetism, for instance, these haven't been explained yet. There's a lot of effort being put into trying to explain these things, but they have not as yet been explained. Now, that's not to say that they're not going to come up with an explanation, but there's a lot. Physicalism does not mean that you're guaranteed to know everything about matter. It's just that you are committed to the idea that all there is matter, or that all you can know is matter. Okay. Okay. Now, this is not really about metaphysics per se, but I think it's still a useful thing to cover, mainly because with physicalists, you see a tendency towards what we call reductionism. Now, there's different kinds of reductionism, some good, some okay, some just kind of excessive, and we'll talk about them. How many have heard of Occam's razor? Okay, Occam's razor. All right. The idea behind Occam's razor is not a horrible idea. The idea is the simplest explanation is usually the best explanation. Okay. What does it sound like? Does it sound like a law? Does it sound like maybe a rule of thumb? Right. Okay. So a rule of thumb has pretty wide application, but not unlimited application. However, what you tend to see is that people will want to apply it in all cases, where there's no necessary reason to apply it in all cases. Okay. So the idea is to reduce a problem or an explanation to the simplest possible explanation, but don't go any farther. In other words, if you come up with a simple explanation, and it's the simplest that is reasonable, don't try to go even simpler, right? It's not useful. Let's see. I didn't write down an example. I won't bother trying to come up with one. It'll take too long. There's a fellow named Karl Popper, who is more recent than William of Ockham. His idea is that simpler theories tend to be more easily testable. So in the realm of science, if you have a simpler theory, it's more easily falsified or tested or whatever. You can disprove it or not disprove it a lot more easily. Okay. If it's a more complicated setup, then it takes more to actually set up the scientific problem to try to explain it or to disprove it. Okay. This is called methodological reductionism, trying to set it up in the simplest form so that you can, you know, grasp it. Okay. Yes. Well, that's a consequence of it. The idea is if your theory, if your hypothesis or your theory is simpler, then it's more easy. The experiment is easier to set up. If you say heat is caused by caloric, which is what they said for a long time, then how are you going to set up an experiment to measure caloric when you don't even know what it is? Okay, if you simplify the problem and eventually change the idea to heat is caused by kinetic energy, well, then you can measure kinetic energy because you understand what that is. Okay, so the experiment is easier to set up. It's easier caloric is sort of just a made-up idea. We don't know really what it is yet. It causes heat. But we do know what kinetic energy and matter are, for the most part. And so it's easier for us to set up the problem.
Okay.
Yeah.
Make that an absentee.
So when you see Occam's razor used in this debate, the existence of God, usually it'll be set up in the terms of, okay, we know about matter, we know about energy, we know about all these things. You're saying all these things plus God. We're saying all these things without God. It's a little simpler, right? How do you measure God? Well, you can't because he's immaterial, so it's a harder problem to solve. Okay. Now, what you'll hear this in the debate that we'll listen to later in the class. You'll hear this when talking to atheists or physicalists or whatever. You'll hear people use this to say that some people will go so far as to say God cannot exist. And that all that shows, all that proves, is that they are committed to what we studied in Scott's class, the empiricist epistemology. All that we can know or do know is known by through sensory experience. Okay. If they don't go that far, then they'll say then we can't know God. Okay. That still shows that they're committed to empiricism. At least they're being a little bit more reasonable about it. Okay. That's methodological reductionism, and you'll often hear it as Occam's razor. People will just say, well, according to Occam's razor. Whatever. Okay. Linguistic reductionism. This you see a lot more often in the philosophical realm, a lot less often in the scientific realm, although it's useful in the scientific realm. The idea is you take a statement such as, the average family has 2.5 children, and then change it to something like, add the children and divide that number by the number of families, and you get 2.5. Okay. Now, in the previous sentence, we had the idea of taking the children, dividing by the number of families, and getting an average. But what statement is in that original sentence? In the average family has 2.5 children. The average family, right? What if you take out the idea of there being an average family? There's no such thing as an average family. So we have to say, add the children and divide that number by the number of families, and you get 2.5. Okay. You'll see this a lot in cases where people don't want to commit to a particular idea. For instance, calling a baby a fetus when he is an unborn baby, right? Technically speaking, the baby is a fetus. But if you call it a baby, then you're going to commit yourself to a particular view when you start saying, yes, I can kill babies, or I cannot kill babies, unborn babies. Okay? This is why they call them fetuses. Okay? How about this one? Red is a color. Okay? I'm going to change that now. Red things are colored things. Okay. Now, I've taken out the idea that red is a color, right? Scott?
No, I'm just
stretching.
Rotating my wrist.
I'll keep that in mind.
It's very
get
quick.
Your attention.
Okay, so if I am not able to commit myself to the idea of there being redness existing in itself outside space and time, then I will not want to say red is a color, unless by that I mean red things are colored things, which we'll talk about a little bit more later. Okay? This is linguistic reductionism. It keeps you from committing yourself to a particular idea. And you'll see it a lot. This is you know, a favorite tool of postmodernists to say that language is simply a web of words made up of other words. When you follow the course of one word, you just find more words. You don't find reality. Reality is simply a web of words interacting with each other. Okay, And some people use these words to oppress other people. This is postmodernism. Okay.
There we go.
We go again. I just, no matter.
Maybe it's good. No. Never mind. It's a. It's just a word. Politician. Just a word. Okay. So if I'm able to reduce my sentences to a simpler ideas, which do exist, we don't disagree the way that red things are colored things, but someone who is a physicalist, for instance, would say that no, red is not a color unless by that you mean red things are colored things. Okay, and red is just something that I use to describe red things. Okay. Tendency towards reductionism. Okay, scientific reductionism. Two categories I'll talk about. One is called strong ontological, or greedy, I think it's been called. And the other is called weak ontological. Ontology just means nature of being, study of being. Okay, so metaphysics is made up of ontology as part of what it's made up of. Okay. So when I say weak ontological or strong ontological, it just has to do with how strongly you tie it to the concept of being. Strong ontological, this is a strong ontological statement. Reality is nothing more than zero-dimensional objects that we call particles. Another view, reality is nothing more than one-dimensional extended objects that we call strings. Okay? Both of these are reductions. When I am hitting this table, the energy, the potential energy of my hand up here, the kinetic energy, all the stuff that's interacting, the actual matter here, it all boils down to either particles in motion or strings. Okay. You're still reducing it all. You can even go as high as saying, my concept of beauty or love boils down to particles, strings. Okay. And there are steps along the way, but that's what you're saying. You're saying ultimate reality is that. Reality is nothing more than. That's strong ontological. Redness is nothing more than a wavelength of light. Okay. When I'm looking at Paul's shirt there, it's reflecting a certain wavelength of light. Okay? That's what redness is. It's that wavelength. It has nothing to do with my concept of redness when I close my eyes. Okay. All right. Pain is nothing more than a state of the brain. Love is nothing more than a state of the hormones in the brain. Love, you know, and so on. This is strong ontological reduction. Yeah.
Well, just as you defined physicalism so far, then that's already self-defeating unless we extend physicalism to include states as well, because states themselves are not objects. So in one definition of the physicalist philosophy, the assumption set includes both physical events, physical objects as well as physical events mm-hmm. that occur within the landscape of space-time. So if you just have objects, then it's very difficult to reduce an event in our brain, which corresponds to the experience of red or love or pain, to just objects and not
right.
you know, events. So as far as in the articulations that I've heard or experienced, it's been acknowledged that the physical universe includes both physical objects as well as physical.
Okay, I think that's just a it's a lack of clarity in my definition then. I think.
That's okay.
There are physical events that are caused by other physical events. We actually mentioned that last week. A fellow named Jaegwon Kim said. He said something important. If any event causes a physical event, it itself is a physical event. Okay. Right. So there are physical events as well. Now, also almost by definition, you have to if you're a physicalist, you have to reduce everything to physical things. Right. So if you're going to talk about love and beauty or red, you're going to have to reduce it to physical things. Right. So this is why we see a tendency towards reductionism, You can say all you want that that person is evil, but really what's the problem is his surroundings have configured himself, his biochemistry such that he is more apt to commit crimes. Okay? You tend to reduce things, yeah.
Jimmy, do you think it's a good idea that when we meet someone who's committed to physicalism, that we apply the reductionism, apply reductionism to that person's physicalism so that they can see the absurdity of it?
Oh, yeah.
You know what I mean?
Answering the fool according to his folly.
No, an example would be right now I'm on a friend of mine has an LDS blog, and he's a Christian, he's an evangelical pastor in Idaho, and a Mormon intellectual by the name of Jacob has come onto the blog, and now I'm in the discussion, and I know the Mormons believe that ultimate reality is matter, and that the gods themselves are composed of matter, and are subject to natural laws and to moral law that somehow just exists in the universe. And so what I'm driving at in my discussions is to show that given the materialistic ontology of Mormonism, how can you have free-floating moral properties? That doesn't make any sense, any more than it makes sense in an atheist worldview where there is just matter. See what I mean? The Mormon gods are just kind of like we might view as like super powerful aliens. You know what I mean? They're not transcendent. They can cease to be God once they become God by choosing the wrong. It's almost like they're just these powerful aliens floating around in the universe that enforce things and have power. That would be an example.
I think so. And I think not only that, you should also just bring up the fact that they are committed by definition to reducing things. So you try to drive them back to what their fundamental pre-commitments are. Show them that there is an I believe before there is an I think. Okay.
It was a profound statement. I don't know if you noticed, but somebody opened the door right when you said monism and dualism, and the door shut. Nobody came in. So I'm just wondering what's going on.
Okay. Yeah. Monotone voice, yeah. Maybe that's the way, anyway.
So, Scott, are we going to learn more about Mormonism in the week that we've been...
Next year, in spring, something like that. I'll give you guys the website. You guys can go there and read some of what's going on.
I have a ton of literature. Ton of literature from the...
Tanners?
The Lighthouse.
Yeah. Is that the Tanners?
Tanners, yeah. Big, huge book. If you guys anyone yeah. want to borrow, you would be in 3 pages. You would be completely baffled, and it's fantastic and wonderful information. If you ever want to read it or borrow it.
Okay. All right. So scientific reductionism. We talked about strong ontological reductionism or greedy, where this tends to be the arena where you go past reasonableness, right? Where earlier we said we try to reduce explanations to the simplest possible but go no further. This is one where people often go further than is reasonable. Okay. The other is weak ontological reduction or reasonable reduction. This is not my word for it, so of course then it's right. I read it on the internet. Heat is explained by kinetic energy, or the structure of water molecules is sufficient to explain wetness. You're not saying so much wetness is nothing more than the structure of water molecules sitting together. It's just that the structure of water molecules sitting together, it's sufficient to explain wetness. Okay. So remember in the logic class we talked about sufficient conditions? If you know that a sufficient condition is true, then you know that it's the consequent as well. The other part of the argument. I have to write it down here. This will be a good review. Okay. P is a sufficient condition to show Q. Q is necessary to show P, but not necessarily sufficient. Okay, so this is a structure of water molecules, and this is wetness. The structure of the water molecules is enough to show wetness. Okay. In other words, if you are not feeling something, but you know that it's water, you measure somehow scientifically that it's water, you can know that it's wet. Okay. That's weak ontological reductionism. It's reasonable to do. If you explain heat in terms of kinetic energy, that's a good thing. You're not making up caloric, which is hard to measure. You're talking about kinetic energy, which you can measure with a thermometer is one way to do it. Okay. And by kinetic energy, which I forgot to define, it just means energy of things moving about. Okay. So if you've got water, you've got a bunch of water molecules jiggling around, right? And they do it at a certain rate. And the faster they do it, the hotter it is. It's kinetic energy. I guess if you were to run into a wall fast enough and frequently enough, it would start getting hotter, I guess. We won't experiment with that one. Yeah, that's true. It would probably break before it got too hot. Okay. That's ultimate reality. And as far as ultimate reality is concerned, physicalists tend to reduce. They try to reduce linguistically, methodologically, and scientifically. Okay? The world is made of matter. Period. Okay? Matter in motion. Energy exists. What energy really is not fully explained yet. What gravity and all these other things are not fully explained yet. But ultimate reality is matter. Okay. Not too complicated. That's all it is. However, let's talk about abstract entities. Okay. A review of last week, we talked a little bit about abstract entities, I think. We talked about immaterial things. We talked about properties. Okay. Anybody remember what a property is? You don't have to.
Blue.
Right. Blueness. Right. Okay. So. Right. This property, if I were to color this in and it were perfectly colored in, it has a property of being approximately round. Right. It has a property of being blue. It has a property of being perpendicular to the floor, more or less. It has a property of being more or less two-dimensional, has the property of being, you know, up here, has the property of not existing 5 minutes ago.
So it has the property of being created.
Mm-hmm. This configuration, right, didn't exist before. All right? Other examples of abstract entities are, for instance, numbers, the concept of 2. Or how many dots are there on this board? Not counting the ones up there. How many big round dots are there? 1, right? 1. What's 1 times 1? Is it always 1? Was it 1 before humans existed? Are you sure? Okay, so propositions. A triangle is similar to another if and only if the angles are congruent. The point is not to tell you about similar triangles. The point is that that statement itself is an abstract entity. It's not simply a set of words. Okay, it's an idea. It's an idea that has existence. Similar triangles are similar. Now this one really does have to do with definition. But the fact that this triangle here and this triangle here are not similar, but this triangle here and this triangle here are more or less similar, okay? That concept exists whether humans exist or not, okay? Not in the words that we used, maybe, but they do relate to each other somehow, okay? That's an immaterial, an abstract entity. Sets, the set of English letters, okay? I'll draw little curly braces here, and I'll say A through Z, right? A through Z, they all have their own existence. But this grouping of them, this particular grouping of them, is called a set. Okay? It's a set. This has existence unto itself. Okay? It exists. relations. This triangle is similar to this triangle. This triangle is bigger than this triangle. Okay. This segment is longer than this segment. Okay. Longer than, bigger than, similar to. These are all relations. I am husband of Sarah. I am friend of people in here. Right. I am teacher of this class. I have a relation to these classes. Does that relation exist simply in physical matter? Or does it actually have an existence in itself? Okay. Is it only a construct of the brain? Or is it an actual construct? I mean, is it an actual entity in and of itself? So these are examples of abstract entities. And you can see why people often use the word metaphysical as kind of an epithet to describe someone who's being overly obtuse. Okay. If I'm spouting off all kinds of sophomoric theories about reality and all that kind of stuff, I might sound like I'm full of sound and fury, signifying nothing, being all metaphysical, right? Okay, that's why the metaphysical poets were called that, because they were actually just a lot more complicated in their descriptions of things than everybody else. It wasn't because they were dealing with the nature of reality, it's because they were more complicated than everybody else. It sounded like they were trying to sound smart, so it was actually almost an insult. Okay, you can kind of see why. Because here we are talking about sets and relations and properties and what does is mean and all these things, right? But, you know, they're important to think about. And we'll talk about how physicalists try to account for these things, okay? Because they actually have a lot harder time than we do. Now, we perhaps limit ourselves in terms of explaining the nature of reality by saying that reality is upheld by God, and that's a very simple answer. It implies a lot of things, and a lot of people get irritated with us when we don't go any farther. Okay, and this is why a lot of physicalists don't like the idea of just saying God did it. And you'll see that talking to non-Christians, some of them anyway. Okay, some options available to the physicalist. How to explain sets, numbers, properties, relations. Well, everything is physical, right? And so if these things have existence, then they are physical, right? Okay. So blueness is physical. It exists somewhere. It exists sometime. Okay. Mental entities are really physical entities. Okay, that is states of mind. I am angry. Whatever. That is just physical. Okay, things that exist in my mind are just physical. Properties and relations are really material. Abstract entities are really physical entities. They're not abstract at all. Okay. And here's probably the most complicated part of the class: trying to explain how these people explain this stuff. Okay. Some positions taken, and don't worry about this. The point is more to convey that they have a hard time explaining reality when they cut out a very large part of reality. That is God, right? The ultimate reality. Okay. Extreme nominalism. Okay. Nominalism has to do with words. Words. It's all words, okay? Red is a word that we use to describe red things, things that emit a certain wavelength of light. Properties do not actually exist, only specific things and the words that describe them. Now, where do the words exist? They're also only in our minds, and we kind of trade them like trading cards, like red. And so now you both have this word in your head somewhere, configured in your memory, and you both use it to describe red things. Okay, that's what redness is, or blueness, or whatever. That's extreme nominalism. There's some important names that won't mean anything to you probably: Quine and some others. Nominalism is a little less extreme. Okay, properties are that which is brought to mind by excluding other things. Okay, Properties are that which is brought to mind by excluding other things. Redness is a set of all properties red for each thing that is red. And not blue. Okay. So if I say red, then I'm actively excluding things that are blue, purple, whatever, soft, fuzzy. This is what nominalism is. Okay. It still kind of boils down to words, but one of the problems is that I had a hard time understanding these things as well. Okay. Versus realism. Okay, these are nominalism versus realism. Christians are realists, by the way. We're realists. Properties are universal. Christians are realists. Properties have real existence. Okay, it's not simply words. It's kind of, you kind of look at reality and I say, what color is this chair?
Mauve.
Okay. These chairs are mauve. All right. Mauve. I say mauve. What is it?
The first, I had that conversation with my mom a few years ago. I said, that's mauve. She said, look in the dictionary and the first pronunciation is mauve.
But there are two?
Yeah, mauve is, but, okay. The world of reading the dictionary.
Which one's real?
Because it's a French word, so it's mauve and then mauve.
Just words. Let's call the whole thing off. Alrighty. Okay, so nominalists say it boils down to words, mental concepts that physically exist in your own head, and you kind of trade these concepts. When you're teaching your children, you sort of convey this concept. You keep correcting them and correcting them until they use the same word that you use to describe a certain thing. Then that word has existence in your child's head as well. When we say red, it's because we're in the same society and culture and language group that we use the word red to describe things at a wavelength of N, whatever the wavelength is. Okay. Right, 760 nanometers. Okay.
Well, you know, it might think, I mean, that what you just said actually is true. You know, that words are, you know, they're merely cultural inventions to describe reality. You know, in one language, dog is dog, another language is perro. And there's no metaphysical necessity why you should call it a dog instead of a perro. You see what I'm saying?
And that's exactly the line of reasoning.
I mean, that makes total sense, but that still doesn't get at the issue of whether, you know, if you erase the number two on the chalkboard, the tunus disappears.
Right.
Tunus continues to exist, or the laws of logic have a transcendent necessity about them.
Right.
Whether we see it or not, that they're actually real laws of thought or real moral properties to which we're obligated. You know, we may use different words to describe them, but they still have real existence.
Yes, words are cultural tags assigned to specific ideas and things. Okay, yeah. So we talked about reductionism earlier, right? This is an example of extreme ontological reduction. We would say that, yes, words are cultural tags assigned to things. They have cultural meaning and influence and history behind them, okay? Okay, these are going to be dinosaurs, whether you like it or not. Let me fix this. I can't. All right. How many dinosaurs are there on this board? Assuming that they're dinosaurs.
There's one. There's a Ski City right there. There's two different ones at different stages of evolution.
Right. Right. This one has wings. All right, so there are two dinosaurs on here. Were there two? If there are no humans around to count them, would there be two dinosaurs?
Oh.
But counting is a human concept. See? Numbers are a human concept used to organize one's sheep or whatever. And they eventually gradually became more complicated in the way that you use them. We started abstracting the idea of variables and then functions and started describing frequencies and frequency spaces and blah, whatever. Okay? I talked to a coworker of mine one time and I asked him, if there were no humans around to count them, how many dinosaurs would there be? He said, it doesn't matter. That was his answer. There's nobody to count them. Okay? Two-ness, to a materialist, is a mental concept, right, used to count things. Huh? There are two dinosaurs here. Whether there's people here or not, it's the same number of dinosaurs. There's one, and then there's another, and then that together makes two. Whether you call it two, whether you have a concept of addition or not, okay? But this is what they say. Reality is nothing more than mental concepts used to describe the physical world. Reality is nothing more than the physical world, okay? Words are nothing more than tags in our minds, physical tags, configurations of however things are stored in our brains, I forget, that are used to describe the world around us.
There's a point of creation.
They don't answer that question.
The point of creation is, when did two come about? So to be a physical sense, it had to have been created at some point.
In somebody's brain,
two had to come to fruition.
Yeah.
So at some point, there's a creation part. There has to be that object, that fact.
Two-ness is contingent upon intelligence.
Right.
I lack the metaphysical, philosophical wherewithal to actually delve into that particular question. I think you're onto something. I have no idea how to explore it.
Well, I think that'd be a good point of saying it all comes back to creation. Everywhere anyone goes scientifically goes back to creation because something has to be created. If it all comes to humanism, comes to physicalism, how did it get there? You can't say that that's not the point, because it is the point. Because it's physical. How did it become physical?
So the answer you'll get is that science does not seek to answer that question. Okay? Science seeks to describe how things are. And so people will say, yes, there is an unanswered question of origins.
Okay?
That's what mythology is for, is what one person said. Okay.
So science should seek to describe and see how things are in hell. Because ultimately, that's where it's going to end up.
Not science in and of itself.
Right.
Humanistic, autonomous science, yes. Yeah.
I thought of if you're talking with an atheist or some materialist reductions, and you're talking about logic, laws of logic, and he is committed to the view that logical laws are merely merely processes of the brain based on empirical observations. I've never seen a car be a car and not a car at the same time in a parking lot. Therefore, I infer the law of non-contradiction from that, that kind of thing. It's good to meet people like that because then you can share with them, well, if that's the case, if there are no real laws of logic that exist, that are transcendent and invariable laws that exist external to our own brains, then logic is simply either a social convention or it's just based on empirical observations, in which case it's not a law. It's contingent upon experience, right? Remember, the problem with empiricism is that they cannot have universal experiences. therefore they cannot justify a universal law of gravity. They cannot justify a law of logic because they have not observed all instances of the said law. Okay, so then you boil down to, you know, well, why are you, you know, how can you use logic against my views when you've not had a universal observation to know if it is indeed a law? Since you're committed to a materialistic ontology, I hope I'm saying it right. I'm having a hard time trying to explain it. But
how can you use something in a law-like way that is not a law in itself?
Yeah, it's not a law in itself, given your worldview, given the way that you look at things.
I think what they would say is it's like a law of gravity. It's kind of resulting from the nature of the way things are, matter is configured. Right. In other words,
say that again.
In other words, you can make a hypothesis. You can work with that hypothesis. This is valid science. The hypothesis ought to be testable. You can test laws of logic. Not. I don't know if you'd call it empirically. Maybe you would. But until you really disprove it, it's a hypothesis you can work with.
Right. But that's far less than claiming that that logic has a law-like obligation to it.
And this is where you come up with the idea of extra logical, right? We heard Gordon Stein say that in the debate that we're going to actually listen to later. He said that, for example, a Zen cone, what is the sound of one hand clapping? Anybody? is a Zen cone. It's extra logical. It doesn't really exist in the realm of logic. Okay, and that's the view that a lot of people have of what faith is. We defined faith earlier in the class as belief in something that has not yet happened yet, has not yet happened or been shown to you. If I've never sat in that chair before, I'm going to sit down in that chair with a measure of faith. Faith that it's like all the other chairs in this room, which I haven't necessarily sat down in, but it's not going to collapse under me because most chairs don't, right? It's a measure of faith. That's how I define faith. That's how Hebrews 11 pretty much defines faith. It's a measure of things hoped for, substance of things not seen, not yet seen, right? Many people define faith in terms of an irrational belief in something, right? And it doesn't necessarily need to fit in the realm of logic. This is this sacred-secular dichotomy that Robert and I were talking about earlier, that there's the idea of there being a scientific realm and the religious-spiritual realm. Spiritual realm kind of exists apart from it. It's fine if you're a Christian, but don't bring it into the science because that'll just muddy the waters, right? Because Christianity is not the same. It's a separate thing, okay? Same with Buddhism or whatever. Okay. What you see, for instance, talking about the laws of logic and other mathematics, is you see this movement called mathematical constructionism, where up until modern era, we'll call the modern era for this class, we'll call it the 1800s or so. Postmodern. Recently, there has been a movement among mathematicians to move away from the idea of mathematics being discovery. Okay, when I discover that 2 is the sum of 1 and 1, okay, I'm not actually discovering it. I'm constructing this concept. Mathematics is no longer discovery, it's construction or creation. You're creating hypotheses, and if they fit with your previous hypotheses, great. Math. The problem is mathematical constructionists cannot use induction. We talked about the problem of induction a little bit. The idea where empiricists, people who are committed to all knowledge being known through sensory experience, cannot take 2 and 3 and 4 and 5 points and draw this line and say, well, then therefore then the point's going to show up there, because they haven't experienced that point. In mathematics, you have an idea of proving what they call the base case, proving that assuming the case for n is true, then and then n plus 1 is true. If you can prove this, then you've got all the way to infinity. Okay? That's induction. A whole lot of math is proved by induction. They've just thrown it all out. Started over. I don't know if they're using it to be convenient. I don't know what. I don't know all that much about the practices of mathematical constructionists. This is a movement that's caused by the metaphysic of materialism or physicalism that says that abstract ideas are actually physical constructions in a brain. Okay. You can't discover things that aren't already in brains. You have to create.
Okay. There is no law-like characteristic to math or to logic. There's no transcendent necessity. It's not something you discover. It's a creation.
If you were to ask them that, they would say that. They would say that there's no law-like nature, unless they define law in their terms, which there's no such thing as law-like in the first place. So they would redefine law in terms of something that just plain hasn't been disproven or probably will ever be disproven. Okay.
My theory is that creation, we are here without creation. Nothing is here without creation.
Right. Okay.
Can I just make a comment to this mathematical constructionism?
Yeah.
So I think the best known example, at least in my line of work, with this idea is the idea that you have geometry that more or less adequately explains and, or at least describes, accurately, more or less accurately describes squares and triangles and things. But it was constructed or observed a while ago that if you change one of the postulates of the set of geometrical postulates, you get an entirely different geometrical space-time in which, you know, parallel lines intersect and, you know, all kinds of other strange things happen. And so the question was rightly asked, well, since we can more or less at whim create any geometrical system we want, it seems pretty much arbitrary that the geometry in which we live just happens to correspond to a particular set of geometrical postulates. And then Einstein came along and said, no, here's a different set that we really live in. So that kind of fueled this perhaps intuition that, you know, maybe geometry isn't a transcendent thing. It's just a set of postulates that we generate and play with. And sometimes we may even want to use them, to send people to the moon or whatever, but they're more or less a playground, a mathematical playground.
Right. And what's interesting about this, and I don't know if we're doing a class on mathematics this year. We did last year. But what that says more to me is that systems that are created by man to describe reality are limited in and of themselves. And this has been mathematically proven, for what it's worth. You have to step outside your system sometimes. Okay. This is going from Euclidean geometry to analytical geometry, I guess, was what it was. But anyway, it was it? Oh, R-E-H-M-A-N?
R-I-E-M-A-N.
Riemann, okay. I don't know if we'll talk about that. It's an interesting idea. The idea that we have to really step out and have God outside our system. Not outside our system, but we have to really bring him in on any complex enough system. Okay. Otherwise, the system's just going to be shown to be an incomplete. Yes. When you need a number, you make it. If you need the number 2 million, you add a million to a million. And then you have an idea of a million.
What's infinity?
Infinity is not a number. It's not really a number. You might call it a tendency. You can't say 2 times infinity. That's not really meaningful.
Oh no, now we're back to politics.
You can say things as X goes to infinity without end. You can talk about infinite sets and that kind of thing, but that just means they never stop growing, you might say. It's not really a number in the... All right, so back to 2 minutes to cover the rest of all reality. Just kidding. Okay, so man in a physicalist world is another animal. There's not much more that's not much different from him, except that intelligence has emerged from complex brain structure. Okay. We're stuck with, you cannot be not stuck with, you have to be stuck with, hard determinism, what they call hard determinism. There's no choice or agency in anything at all. It's physical events causing other physical events, which to us look like choices. But they're not choices at all. Okay? Now just ponder that for a little while. Wonder and figure out what the ethic of that's going to be. Okay? What's your morality going to be like when you say there's no choice? Morality is all about choices.
Well, it's no wonder so many people are going towards saying the death penalty is wrong. Well, if we didn't make that choice, it was just part of
society
the environment
and
around us. It's no wonder that it leads to the lack of moralism, and what's right for one is not necessarily for another, and they shouldn't be held accountable if that was their genetic, maybe even say tendency, if that was their genetic makeup. You understand why society is going to do this.
Yeah. Now, don't forget that everybody believes in God. They're just suppressing it, right? But maybe they don't believe in God. They know God. Okay. So we can't throw that out. There's the reason that God's, this is the way that God's common grace has worked through society, even when you start committing yourself to this hard determinism idea, the astonishing hypothesis of Francis Crick. You still have people saying, well, you ought to do whatever. You ought to be committed to the utilitarian ethic that says you're trying to go for the most happiness. You ought to. You're morally obligated to. Okay. So you still have image bearers of God making these decisions. So, but you're right. It's not surprising that when someone is more educated in this particular school that they end up becoming more foolish. Okay. I'm going to skip over Neo-Darwinism. I'm going to talk about Hinduism. Hindus believe that ultimate reality is all is one. Okay, the world. Maya or illusion. The truth is hidden. It's not lost, but it's hidden. Okay, so the fact that I'm different from this podium is illusion. Okay? Got it? That's Hinduism. And to a pretty big extent, most what they call the Vedic religions, religions that are basically in the same family, Buddhism and Sikhism and some others. Okay, all is one. One is Brahman or God. Man is closer to liberation than the animals and plants, but he's really not any different from animals and plants. Karma affects a soul's future life. If you get good karma points, then you'll have a better life. More karma points than anti-karma points or whatever.
What about the death?
Will
they get karma points?
Yeah. I mean, it'll be reborn as whatever. I don't know what... Yeah. The fact that I am an individual and if it's not an individual is illusion. The fact that I have more karma points than you and whatever.
That's fantastic.
The caste system... is built into part of this idea that they're humans, yeah, but some of them had lower karma points, and they had, I say karma points, so nobody talks like that. It's like a video game or something. Right. Caste system is fundamental to their society largely because they believe that you were born there. I mean, sorry. Do good. Maybe you'll get better. Now, what's funny is you start getting into situations like, well, the fact that I am not in nirvana is an illusion. So is this all there is to it? You know, because the goal is to go from where you are now into nirvana, right? By getting enough karma points, whatever the threshold is. You don't.
That sounds a lot like Mormonism.
except that, when you reach nirvana, all of a sudden, all is one, and you realize it, only it's not you. It's all is one. All right.
It's extra logical.
There we go. Logic is a Western thing, you logic choppers. Which is interesting, because actually there is a pretty rigorous system of logic in Hindu mathematics, but they have this divide, right?
They divide.
Anyway, the thesis of this class is one's view of reality affects all other aspects of life. It affects the way you look at knowledge. It affects the way you look at ethics. It affects the way you look at individual human beings, unborn, born, old, in pain, poor. Okay? And it's all colored by sin. Okay? That's it. Scott, could you close this, please?